Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my coat.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Caroline Levitt, New York Times best-selling author of the new novel, Days of Wonder. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We're now just 8 days before Passover begins, and as we prepare for the coming Pesach Festival of Freedom, one central fact about this great holiday must be noted. Passover is at heart a primal story about both emigration, leaving slavery in a nation that brutally persecutes its minorities, and immigration, about a ragged mass of former slaves who move to a new promised land, seeking personal and religious freedom with the opportunity to build lives based on their own hard work and dedication. We Hebrews were wanderers from our earliest beginnings with Abraham and Sarah, but we became a nation of wandering Jews, or at least wandering Israelites, when God and Moses took us out of Egyptian bondage and led us to Israel. Immigration is in our souls, probably in our DNA. There's even a kind of Darwinian reason for this. The Jews who did not leave their home countries seeking a better life often were later murdered there, and those communities diminished or disappeared, while the Jews who emigrated seeking a better life often flourished, in spite of the many dangers involved. And that means that it should be virtually impossible for any Jew not to understand what motivates immigrants who seek to come to a nation promising freedom of opportunity. Our sympathies always are with those who try to find a life free of persecution in countries where they have this possibility to create lives of safety, success, and stability. That makes the current and, fairly recent anti-immigrant rhetoric in America particularly painful for Jews. We know everyone in the United States is descended from an immigrant. Even the Native Americans walked here on a land bridge from Asia, and the idea that any of us have forgotten our ancestors were migrants themselves, many of them not terribly well documented, that should be profoundly disturbing. It's true. America has typically had both pro- and anti-immigration strains in its ideology. Usually, businesses wanted more immigrants, and poor laborers wanted fewer or none, since they saw immigrants as economic competitors who might lower wages. There have even been entire political parties in America based on anti-immigrant sentiment, like the well-named anti-Catholic Know-Nothing Party that tried to stop Irish and German immigration in the mid-19th century. It won 20% of the vote in a national presidential election once. But the larger truth is that America, as actor Bill Murray famously said in the movie Stripes long ago, America is a nation of mutts. We are great precisely because we are diverse. And the energy of every generation of immigrants who had the initiative to leave persecution, poverty, and war and seek a new life here has created the great country that we are. Passover, which celebrates freedom, also most certainly celebrates immigration. And so, to play us in this morning, just 8 days before Pesach begins, the first Seder is 1 week from tomorrow night, April 22nd at sundown. Oh, and sign up for our second night Seder at Beit Simcha, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Anyway, to celebrate Passover, here's Yonatan Razel and Yaakov Shweki singing a text from the Passover Haggadah, Vehi She'amda. This is the promise that sustained our fathers in us. It's not one enemy alone that stood up against us to destroy us, but in each generation, there are those who stand up against us to destroy us, but the Holy Blessed One saves us from their hand.
עולנו לך בנסינו
והיא שעמד על אבותינו והיא שעמד על אבותינו ולנו שלא אחד בלבד עמד עלינו לך נותנו עמד עלינו
That was V'hi She'amda from the Haggadah for Passover, coming to a Seder near you in 8 days. You can come to our extraordinary Passover Seder with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, second night of Pesach, Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 p.m. at 12111 North La Jolla. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. As Moses said, more or less, let our people rejoice. Make this year a Seder to remember. One more note about this Passover. Last week marked 6 months that Israeli hostages have been held by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas in captivity in and under Gaza. This year at our Seders, we will include a remembrance of all those Jews who are not free at all, who have been brutally stolen from their lives, tortured, kept as pawns to use to protect the Palestinian terrorists who provoked this Gaza war. May those hostages be saved soon, even during this season that celebrates freedom, perhaps. Our guest this morning is New York Times bestselling author Caroline Levitt, whose new novel, Days of Wonder, is an extraordinary story of murder and atonement. Meet Caroline when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Caroline Levitt is the author of Days of Wonder, a new novel. She is a New York Times bestselling author. That they don't give that out like for free. It's a big deal. An excellent writer and a wonderful guest. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the origins of Days of Wonder.
Days of Wonder came about with two divergent paths. The first one was that I had this friend for a few years who was this wonderful woman. Everybody really loved her. And after 2 years, she told me, I have something I have to tell you. And I thought, oh, what is that going to be? And she told me that when she was 15, she had committed a murder. And she went to prison for it. And she was early released after 5 years. And she decided then that she was going to remake her life. She took on a new identity. She did everything well to try to earn forgiveness. And she had a life until about 20 years later when she was in her 40s. She was outed by somebody. She lost friends. She lost jobs. She just kept asking, when am I going to be forgiven? And I wanted to write about that, but I wanted to protect her privacy. So I turned it more into a Romeo and Juliet story about two kids, both 15, who were accused of an attempted murder they just couldn't remember. But as I started writing, something interesting happened to me. My mother had died 3 years ago, and her story started to permeate the narrative. Now, my mother was one of eight kids, and she grew up in an Orthodox Jewish household, and she absolutely adored her father, who was the local rabbi. And when she was 18, her father died very suddenly of a heart attack while in the synagogue. And my mother was so horrified and so traumatized that she told herself that she was going to give up her religion. She wasn't going to pursue it. She was just going to, like, you know, just give it up, because she didn't want anything to do with a God who would take her father. So what happened, though, is she couldn't let it go. The whole time I was growing up, I felt my mom's yearning for that community again. And she would sort of veer into it and pull out and veer into it. And I just, you know, as I was researching, because I actually have a Hasidic person in my novel, I asked every single person who left the Hasidic community, which is much more very restrictive, what they missed. And they all said the same thing. They missed that community. They missed that sense of belonging and of love and connection. And I started to write about that. I just really wanted to write about that because I realized how important it was. In fact, when I had a son of my own, my husband and I made sure that he knew about his heritage, and he got a bar mitzvah. And when he got one, I stood up. My mom was there, and she was crying, and I was crying. Ooh. And it just sort of felt like we were all kind of coming home together.
That's beautiful. The story itself is extraordinary. We will talk much more with Caroline Levitt about her new book, Days of Wonder, and her many other books, I should add, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-age children and grandchildren. Our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah program, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting of great Jewish learning, celebrating our sixth year. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. And coming up fast, Tuesday night, April 23rd, our fabulous Second Night Seder will be led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Songs, stories, reflections on freedom, creativity, and fantastic food from Catalina Caterers. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night or Saturday morning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join us every Friday night, 6:30 p.m. with an Oneg Shabbat to follow. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services with a Kiddush afterwards, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page, you can find our services, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and Zoom. You can access those by going to the website, Beit Simcha Tucson. For more information about us, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, our fantastic Second Night Seder, our rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, taught live and on Zoom, our Passover morning services, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the most dynamic and fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona, Beit Simcha. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio18@gmail. Or go to our website, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating. Please review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, Pesach is coming up fast, another, 8 days or something like that. And there's a passage in the Haggadah when we open the door for Elijah, Shvoch Hamachal Hagoyim, pour out your wrath upon the nations that attack us. It's pretty strong. It has never felt great to me to say it, but this year it feels kind of different. You have a family memory of that passage.
It's a very strong passage, which always made me feel uncomfortable too. But I remember as a kid, my grandfather of blessed memory used to conduct the Seder, and he wore a white kitzel and a bishop's hat and the whole nine yards.
The whole routine.
And the place he got most excited and almost gleeful, certainly more like alive, was when he said Shvoch Hamaschal Goyim. You know, he still spoke Ashkenazic Hebrew, but
Shvoch Hamaschal Goyim.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, I mean, he and his new bride left Hungary because of anti-Semitism in the very early 20s, and their honeymoon trip brought them to the U.S. They didn't have their honeymoon immediately after their marriage. They had to get visas. They had to do all kinds of things. So it was many months. And actually, my father was born just a few weeks after they arrived in the U.S. So first, they stayed with my grandfather's brother in Kansas City. Then they moved to an uncle of my grandmother's who had a dry goods store in Yale, Oklahoma, which was this little boom town during the oil boom in Oklahoma,
right,
which could only be reached by dirt roads and covered wagons. And my grandmother eventually insisted on leaving because by the time the kosher meat got there from Kansas City, it was green with mold and disgusting, and she felt she couldn't raise children without meat. You know, this was long before veganism was a thing, right?
Very Jewish in that era, absolutely.
Right. So my grandfather, working in this dry goods store with very few words of English, but lots of people in that area were of German origin. So my grandfather spoke German, of course, and Hungarian. No Yiddish, but German and Hungarian for sure. And one of his biggest customers was the local chapter of the Klan, because
the Ku Klux Klan.
The Ku Klux Klan wears white sheets, right? And they bought their white sheets from my grandfather, and they invited him to join their club. Uh-huh. And he had no idea. And was my grandfather was a very agreeable, easygoing guy, liked to socialize. He was like on a football team in high school and whatever. So he went to the club meetings for a couple months. And by then he learned enough English to realize what was going on. And he said at some point, he bowed out very gracefully. He said, you know, I think if you knew more about me, you wouldn't really want me in your club. So I'm going to bow out before I get kicked out. So I'm the only Jewish person I know who is a grandparent who was once a Klan member, however briefly.
Wow. Well, and you know, he could have used the same white cloth to make his kittel for Pesach, actually, if you think about it.
Right.
It's quite a story, Tom. You are definitely, I've heard vague stories about Jews being in the Ku Klux Klan in the South. You know, they didn't know what was going on, or they were the only merchant in town and they had a good relationship and that Jew was okay. But usually if they knew you were Jewish, they really did not want you in the Klan or in their town. It's an interesting Pesach story and a very different one for this year. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. With Passover just a week away, the Jewish community in Madrid, Spain, found itself in a desperate situation. There was an acute shortage of horseradish, key ingredient of the fiery condiment for gefilte fish, also known as chrein. A cry arose, and the whole community mobilized in an effort to prevent this shanda, this shameful tragedy. All the EU countries gave the same reply. Sorry, we have no horseradish to send. In desperation, the Madrid rabbi phoned one of his friends in Tel Aviv and begged him to send a crate of horseradish, of chrein, by air freight to Madrid. And 2 days before Passover, a crate of grade A, tear-jerking Israeli chrein horseradish, loaded at Ben-Gurion Airport onto an El Al flight, got to Madrid, all seemed to be well. But when the rabbi went to the Madrid airport to claim the horseradish, the chrein, he was informed that a strike had just broken out and no shipments would be unloaded for at least a week. He was able to get a few ounces, but not nearly enough for all of the Jews in Spain. You guessed it. As a result, the chrein in Spain stayed mainly on the plane. Sorry about that. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week in Temple, we read the portion of Mitzora in the book of Leviticus, focusing on the question of leprosy, a dread disease of the ancient world. It's true, leprosy was awful and had to be eliminated if at all possible, in particular using quarantines to isolate the people who had it. As recently as the 20th century, lepers were often still isolated in remote colonies. The Hawaiian island of Molokai, famously, was thought of as the leper island, and today it exists in a much more limited way in many countries. About half the cases of leprosy occurring are in India. It is likely that the biblical Mitzora, or Tzara'at, leprosy, was a whole category of skin diseases, deformations, that were viewed as potentially dangerous and contagious, infecting even, they thought, clothing and houses. Well, it's interesting, but exploring an infectious disease our ancestors feared in Torah study or at a Shabbat service can scarcely be called a spiritually uplifting experience. The rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem long ago. They came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word mitzorah was itself, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew motzi shem ra, meaning slander or evil speech. Their interpretation was based on evidence in the Torah itself. Moses' own hand became leprous when he expressed doubt about the willingness of the people to believe in his mission. His sister Miriam was struck by leprosy when she gossiped about Moses, slandering him. The leper was thus a person who had spoken badly about others and should be shunned for doing so. Now, they did not mean the person actually infected with leprosy, but anybody who engaged in evil speech. You see, evil speech, Lashon Hara, and its even darker partner, Motzi Shemra, slander, are considered by Judaism to be among the worst sins of all. What must be eliminated from society is not just the biological illness of leprosy, but these terrible infections of slander and gossip. The ways in which we employ language lead to many of the worst problems in society. Lashon Hara, Maimonides taught, is not only a kind of terrible epidemic disease, but even a multiple murderer, killing three people: the one who shares the gossip, the one who listens to the gossip, and of course, the one who is the subject of gossip. According to Jewish law, even gossip with a kernel of truth inside is Lashon Hara and inherently wrong. It causes intense societal damage. Some authorities, like the great rabbi known as the Chofetz Chaim, go so far as to say that gossiping about the truth also can be morally heinous. There is a kind of parallel in our own law code in the U.S. There's a legal concept in American jurisprudence called the fruit of the poisoned tree, which rules out the use of evidence collected improperly. That is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted and not legally admissible. It is similar with mitzorah, slander, and all other forms of lashon hara, evil gossiping speech. Whether the gossip has an element of truth in it or not, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupt source. It brings poison wherever it goes. You know, I've personally experienced the ways that false and defamatory speech, wielded both deliberately to destroy and inadvertently by weak people, can cause tremendous damage. I've also seen Motzi Shemra, simple slander, used to extort money or power. These sins are not restricted to lay people, of course. Even rabbis can and have engaged in these actions in our own community, in our national associations, and some continue to do so. Our goal should be to completely eliminate from our lives the habit of Motzi Shemra, the awful tendency we have to speak ill of others. The great rabbis teach that if you commit no slander, your own life will become clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that damage others, we can find our way clear to living better, holier lives. Our portion this week even delineates forms of mitzorah that affect the very houses in which we live, called mitzorah ad bayit. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of property, it may even need to be destroyed. That's along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. If we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations, synagogues, communities in which holiness flourishes, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated too. May we each do our part, now and always, to remove mitzorah, personal impurities of speech, from our own lives, our institutions, and our community. When we return in a moment, our guest, Caroline Levitt, explains why she writes so beautifully about such, well, horrifying subjects as murder and incarceration. Find out from Caroline, who has such a sunny disposition, why she does this when she rejoins us in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, published a report card last week grading universities and colleges in the U.S. based on how friendly to Jewish students they are. Only two higher education institutions, Brandeis University in Massachusetts and Elon University in North Carolina, earned A's from the ADL. Brandeis, a private, non-sectarian school, has historically been a go-to school for Jewish students. Among the reasons cited for its high grade was its decision several months ago to ban the campus chapter of the Students for Justice in Palestine organization. The reasons for Elon's high grade include hosting an event after Hamas's brutal attacks on October 7th, encouraging students and faculty to hold a respectful conversation about the Middle East conflict. All the Ivy League schools except Dartmouth received either a failing grade of F or a D. Dartmouth got a C. The 13 schools receiving an F were Harvard, Princeton, Stanford, MIT, Virginia, Tufts, Swarthmore, Michigan State, University of Chicago, SUNY Purchase, Long Island University, Brooklyn, UMass Amherst, and the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Fs for all for Jewish students. In compiling the report, the ADL reviewed 85 schools that are either highly ranked academically or known to attract large numbers of Jewish students. It consulted a panel of experts using recommendations drafted by the U.S. National Strategy to Counter Antisemitism and drew up a list of 21 criteria for assessment of the colleges. These included administrative actions and policies, incidents on campus, Jewish student life, and so on. 15 schools got a B, not bad, including the University of Arizona, Duke, Maryland, Texas, at Austin, Florida State, Miami, University of Florida, and Washington University in St. Louis. 31 schools got a C, including Arizona State, Dartmouth, NYU, Vanderbilt, Penn State, Emory, Tulane, University of Central Florida, Boston University, American University, Syracuse, Oberlin, Queens College, University of Wisconsin, Carnegie Mellon, USC, and George Washington. 24 schools were given a D, including Brown, Columbia, Barnard, Berkeley, UCLA, well, frankly, all the UCs got a D, Johns Hopkins, Caltech, Wellesley, Cornell, Rutgers, Northwestern, Rice, Ohio State, and the University of Pennsylvania, as well as Illinois and Georgetown. That is quite a report card from the ADL. Not too optimistic. And, citing the biblical teaching of till and tend the earth, the Union for Reform Judaism announced last week it's committed to ensuring its investment and pension plans and its mutual funds are free of direct ties to oil, gas, and coal companies. It is redirecting its investment towards renewable energy and away from fossil fuels. Jennifer Brodke Kaufman, the chair of URJ's North American Board, said, "Climate change's impacts are being felt in communities worldwide. We have the ability and responsibility to use our dollars to make a positive difference on climate rather than to continue funding investment in damaging fossil fuels." A spokesperson for the URJ said that up to 9% of the organization's financial portfolio is currently invested in the fossil fuel industry, but it did not provide a dollar figure quantifying the planned divestment. The URJ reported about $83 million in investment assets in 2022, the most recent year for which it has released financial statements. Now, mind you, $83 million may sound like a lot of money, but that would mean maybe $8 million is being divested? I suspect Elon Musk loses that much on Twitter, X, before lunch every day. Still, more than a third of American Jews identify with the Reform movement, whether or not they actually belong to Reform synagogues, making the URJ's pledge one of the highest profile actions taken within the Jewish community yet to help reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that are warming the planet and causing so many natural disasters. About 850 congregations are part of the Reform movement in North America. They take guidance from the URJ but make financial decisions independently. While many individual Jews have been active in the climate movement for decades, the URJ pledge is emblematic of the increased attention communal organizations are paying to the climate issue in recent years. It comes less than 2 weeks after Oregon's two Jewish federations announced fossil fuel divestment plans, first to do so across the 146-chapter Jewish Federation system. The apparent trend suggests the Jewish community could eventually catch up to other faith-based groups who have long expressed their values through investment strategies, whether on climate, tobacco, or guns. The Jewish divestment push is being led by the climate advocacy group Dayenu, whose founder and CEO, Rabbi Jenny Rosen, is a Reform rabbi, classmate and friend of mine, and a past guest of Too Jewish when she started Dayenu. Imagine that. I commend the reform movement for drawing a clear ethical line, ensuring our investments are not furthering climate destruction, Rosen said in a statement. It's time for all Jewish institutions to follow the reform movement's leadership and make their own public commitments to move investments out of fossil fuels and instead invest toward a just and livable clean energy future.
'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey! Now we got problems, and I don't think we can solve them. You made a really deep cut, and baby, now we got bad blood. Hey!
In the recent trend of theme-based Haggadot for Pesach, they have come out with a Taylor Swift Haggadah. The unofficial Taylor Swift Haggadah was written by author Nama Ben David and inspired, of course, by her teenage daughter, who is a true Swiftie. Mind you, we have had Martin Bodek as a guest on Too Jewish before, who created a whole series of these kinds of Haggadahs, the Festivus Haggadah, the Coronavirus Haggadah, the Shakespeare Haggadah, and the Emoji Haggadah. I'm not sure how Martin Bodek missed this one, except maybe he doesn't have a teenage Swiftie daughter. Anyway, Taylor Swift, who I must remind you is not Jewish, was Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2023. You would think her chokehold on the zeitgeist would have led Martin to this obvious product line choice. Look, I don't think we need to get too deeply into the Taylor Swift Haggadah itself, except to say that it makes perfect thematic sense for the Queen of Breakup Songs to be featured in one of the most dramatic breakup stories of all time, the exodus of the Israelites from slavery to the Egyptian pharaoh. I mean, that's a built-in Taylor Swift song, right? Well, whichever Haggadah you use for Pesach, and I edited one myself some years ago, we hope that you're getting ready 8 days from now. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Too Jewish. Our guest this morning, Caroline Levitt, is a novelist. Her new book is called Days of Wonder. It's a terrific story and a complicated one. She has written, I want to say, 11 books total. Does that sound right?
13.
Sorry, I didn't mean to short you. A number of novels, but you know, it's funny. It always feels to me in reading your novels like there's a grounding in nonfiction. Like you make sure that things sound real. Is that by choice?
Yeah, I do. I did a whole lot of research for this book. I wanted to get the Hasidic community, exactly right. So I spoke to Leah Lack, who is a best-selling author of the book Uncovered, about how she left her Hasidic community.
Yep.
And I spoke to this other amazing woman, Beatrice Weber, who actually just recently sued, well, she also left the Hasidic community, and she sued New York for not providing good enough secular education.
Right,
and she
right.
She won. She's incredible. Both of them were incredible. But I had them both vet my pages, and we had a lot of talks, and I talked to, because there was all the legal stuff, I talked to a New York City defense lawyer and then a criminal lawyer, and I really like research because I really like learning things and I really like talking with people.
The story itself about somebody being a secret murderer, by the way, I have to tell you, it spoke to me in a strange way. I had a congregant once, very nice person, who came to me, and I'd known them for several years, and told me that they had done, I'm making it as vague as possible, a number of years in an Illinois prison for killing their father. You know, and I'd known them as just this really sweet person because their father had been abusing their mother and came to defend him, knifed him, killed him. And it was just sort of like, okay, what do I do with this? What I did with it was just not tell anybody, you know, like that's what you do as a rabbi sometimes. But it struck me that, like, we don't always know the people around us, do we?
No, we don't. And also, people are capable of a lot of things, but there's a difference between somebody who commits a terrible crime, who's unrepentant,
right,
and still goes on that way, and somebody who realizes what they've done and makes actual amends for it and tries to be a better person about it and learns from it. And you know, that was the thing that struck me. I did research on women in prison. I went to this thing in Massachusetts called Changing Lives Through Literature, where women on probation discuss books and they discuss their lives. And I was lucky enough to go, and I was really honest with the women, and they were really honest with me, and they all felt that they knew they had done things that were wrong, though they wouldn't, you know, they nobody spoke about what they did, but they all wanted to be part of life again and to be forgiven. And to me, that's the thing that counts the most.
In developing Days of Wonder, as you said, you know, you fictionalized this story and you got deeper and deeper into, you know, some of the background of the Jewish community aspects of it, the Hasidic aspects of it. What struck you the most as you dug?
It was really the longing people had for community. I spoke to this writer, Shalom Dean, who was a member of a really ultra-strict sect upstate. And he lost all his children when he left. And when he tried to come back to see them, there was violence. And I asked him the same question I asked everybody, like, is there anything you miss from that community? And he was quiet for a minute and he said, I miss the connection. You know, I miss the community. I feel like I'm a stranger in a strange world. And that thing really struck me because I also grew up because of my mom without, I knew I was Jewish, but, and we celebrated the major holidays, but I didn't really know much about my heritage, and it made me feel like much more of the other than I would have anyway. Plus, we lived in this all Christian neighborhood, and we were the only Jewish family, and it was really hard for me because a lot of times people would come up to me and they would say things like, oh, you kill Christ, where are your horns, or whatever.
Nice.
And I actually had friends in high school who told me that they weren't allowed to be friends with me because I was Jewish. So it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized, you know what, there's a whole community out here. There's a whole lot of people out there, and you just have to sometimes look, find it.
I want to ask you about Poison.
Great question. There's this woman, I wrote her name down and I can't find, of course, she's called the Poison Lady.
You do mention her, and I don't know if we want to give her press. I'm a little concerned here.
She's wonderful. She's called the Poison Lady, and every writer I know who writes any sort of mystery or crime knows her. And I wrote her and said, I need a kind of poison. And I have this kid he's a would-be botanist, so I need it to be a plant. And I need it to be a plant that can both heal somebody and hurt them. So she said, oh, you want foxglove? Because foxglove has something in it that's helpful for people with heart conditions. But if you take too much of it, it can kill you.
Right.
So I thought, oh, that's perfect. And plus, it's a really beautiful plant, which made it all more interesting. So after I talked to the poison lady, I called an ER doctor, and I asked him, how can you tell if somebody has foxglove poisoning? And to my surprise, he said, oh, we see that all the time. And he gave me all the symptoms, and he told me all the tests they would do, and he told me how somebody could survive that. And it was just fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating.
So we're getting close to Pesach now, the great festival of freedom. People think that when you're let out of slavery, you're free, but it's not really like that. And I think the same thing probably applies to people who have paid their debt to society, have been in prison. Can you reflect on that a little bit?
Yes, I think that's a brilliant question. I think it's absolutely right. I mean, there's always kind of a melancholy almost in Jewish people because of all we've suffered through and struggled through the ages. My character, Ella, yeah, she's free from prison, but there's still a cost. And the cost is the one thing she wants more than anything, which is community. Because when people hear that she's been a felon, they react differently. People don't know what to do, especially if they hear someone attempted a murder when they were a child. And my purpose was I wanted Ella to have a kind of freedom at the end by realizing that not everybody is going to forgive her. But the main thing is that she needs to forgive herself in some way. And she needs to live with that feeling that everything is not necessarily black and white, that by going out and being a good person and forging ahead, she can put out good in the world. And sometimes that's all you can do. You're not going to convince people who won't forgive you to forgive you sometimes, no matter what you do.
The development of character in a novel is maybe the most complicated aspect of it. I don't think all authors manage it. How do you think about the way that people change in when you work on them? You've written a lot of novels. Is there a set process, or does it happen organically for you?
It's, for me, it's both. I do a lot of structural work for about 6 months before I actually start writing. And I try to figure out, what is it that this character wants and why? And what's the character's misconception about it? It's like some people really want to be rich, and they make a plan to be rich. They're going to go to the right school and meet the right person. They're not going to take a job unless it's in finance or something. And their misconception is that that's going to make them happy. And a lot of people, when they get that, they realize they don't like the job. They're not happy in their life. And what they really need is to, do something more meaningful to them, like be a painter or teach or whatever else. So I try to figure that out. And then I try to figure out what the person's ghost is. What's haunting them that they don't know how to heal? And for Ella, what was haunting her was always she didn't know what really happened that night. And she felt so guilty, and she was so haunted by all these questions. And in order to be more free, she had to find the answers to them. So I do all this talking and thinking, and I cut out pictures of what I think the characters look like and paste them on my wall so it's like they're in conversation with me. And it's just a question of continually asking, why would somebody do this? Why do they think they're doing this? And why are they really doing this? Which is always a different question.
Okay, it's a different kind of question. How long does it take you to write a novel?
4 years. It takes me a really long time. It's usually the publisher wants them in 2 years. So I do a lot of pre-work before I submit anything. It takes me like 6 months to figure out the characters. Then I take another 3 months or so to write what I call a detailed writer's synopsis, which is basically all the scenes and what I think is going to happen. And I might write them out on colored post-its, and I'll put them on the floor and I'll rearrange them to see which way works best. And then when I start writing, I write about literally 16 drafts, and then I send it to some writer friends of mine so they can tear it apart. And only then do I send it on to my agent. And she always has comments too. So it takes a really, really long time.
The idea of focusing on people in conflict. Like, there's not a lot of happy, good novels, right?
Well, you know, the weird thing is that I'm a really happy person, and people have called me Pollyanna in my life because I'm so, I feel so optimistic. And my viewpoint on life is that sometimes when you've suffered terrible tragedies or awful things happening, you appreciate the joy so much more, and you can be so much happier because you recognize this moment and it's so wonderful. I try to do that for my characters in my books, and sometimes I feel that I write these kind of thorny novels because it allows me to be happy in my life, and that's why I do it.
Well, I mean, you've written about, like, the Manson family, but I mean, you know, really cheerful stuff here. The Vietnam War, you know, great.
I will tell you, the research on the Manson family was really fascinating because I found somebody that had lived next to them. And I said, well, what did you think of him? And he said, oh, we all just thought that they were kind of dirty and vagrants and they weren't that smart. And I just found that really interesting. The other interesting story is that Charles Manson really wanted to be a singer. And he wrote a song with one of the Beach Boys. And, you know, who knows what a different trajectory his life might have taken. I don't think it would have because of who he was. But, no, I'm drawn to things like that. Maybe it's kind of like keeping the evil eye away from me. But I like to write about that. It makes me happier in my regular life.
It's fascinating. You know, you think that people who write about darkness are dark, but that's clearly not the case with you, Caroline, I have to say.
Well, you know, most comics and comedians are very serious. Yeah. I had a chance to meet Steve Martin once. And he was so serious. He didn't smile at all. He was incredibly shy, very, very anxious. And, you know, his comedy is the other side of him.
The wild and crazy guy, yeah.
No, not at all.
Well, maybe it's the banjo playing. I don't know. Maybe. Caroline, I want to thank you for a wonderful visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about Days of Wonder, which is a terrific novel?
Thank you so much. They can go to my website. It's my name, CarolineLevitt.com.
Two T's, by the way, LEAVITT.
Oh, yes, right. CarolineLevitt.com, or I'm always on Facebook at Caroline Levitt. I'm on Twitter at Levitt Novelist, and I'm very, very easy to find, and I always answer emails. And my email is just my name at Gmail.
Thank you so much. And an early chag sameach, a happy Passover.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. I'm so thrilled to be on this show. I just appreciate all your questions and the laughter, too. That always makes an interview fun.
Well, thank you. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Gene Blasberg, podcaster and author of the new novel, Reimagining the Story of David and Bathsheba, Daughter of a Promise. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page. And definitely sign up now for our magnificent second night Seder at Beit Simcha, Tuesday, April 23rd. Prime ribs, one of the possible meals. It's just a week and a day, a week and 2 days away. Let our people rejoice. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to register now. Our playout this morning comes from 613. It's their a cappella version of Pesach according to The Lion King. Because Passover's coming up, and it's silly but ridiculously well done. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
like will never be done. There's more to clean than can ever be cleaned. Grab a candle and search for the crumbs. When the cedar table is ready and all the chametz has been found.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.